Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
On April 23rd, the Federal Trade Commission promulgated a final rule that banned employee non-compete agreements nationwide as of September 2024. Now, non-competes have been a staple in many industries, and the long-awaited final rule has already been subject to judicial challenge. So, why did the FTC make this move, and what is its likely impact? We're lucky to be joined this morning by Anna Rathman, an expert in competition law and a partner at Latham & Watkins, where I had the privilege to practice for many years. Morning, Anna. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And let's start with non-competes 101. What are the agreements we are talking about? How do they work?
Yeah, so non-compete agreements are where an employee agrees not to compete with their employer after the employment relationship ends. So this is by going to work for another competitor of the employer or starting their own business that will compete with the employer. And you can usually find these in an employment agreement that you signed when you begin your employment. But they also can be in employment handbooks, company policies, things like that.
And that was, as I understand it, they were relatively widespread. What is the scope of the final rule? What has the FTC tried to do here?
Yeah, so the FTC has issued a final rule that says that it is an unfair method of competition in violation of Section 5 of the FTC Act for a person to enter into or enforce a non-compete clause with a worker. There's a small couple of carve-outs for this. So senior executives who make more than $150,000, those non-competes will remain in place. But going forward, the FTC says there should be no additional non-competes, even with senior executives. And there's also a little bit of a carve-out for non-competes in connection with a sale of a business.
Now, how significant are non-compete agreements in the marketplace?
So the FTC estimates that about 30 million Americans are subject to non-competes. I think they're pretty, you know, widely used in all sorts of different industries, ranging from, you know, low wage workers to executives and C-suite level folks. They really, I think, are you know, quite common.
And is it typical that it's like a knowledge-based type worker, or is it, you know, an executive, or could it be at any level within that?
Yeah, you know, it can really be at any level. I think that when we think of non-competes, we do tend to think of more senior level employees who might have, you know, relationships with clients or, you know, insight into the competitive, sensitive business information of companies, but they can also be applied to lower wage workers or workers at lower levels where a company has really invested in training those employees. Maybe, you know, you go to work for a small business and the small business really trains you up in what they are doing and puts a lot of time and investment into that. And those small businesses are looking to prevent their employees from, you know, taking the benefit of that training and then leaving right away and moving to a competitor firm.
So who was behind the effort to abolish them? Is this something organic that comes out of the mind of Lena Khan, or has there been sort of a widespread push for this from somebody?
Yeah, you know, I think that labor, the intersection of labor and competition law has been something we've seen growing throughout the years. You know, even as early as 2016, the DOJ and FTC issued HR guidance for HR professionals related to agreements between businesses for no poach agreements and things like that. At the beginning of the Biden administration, President Biden issued an executive order sort of instructing the FTC to take a look at some of these labor issues in the competition context. And so I think it's something that, you know, has been in the minds of antitrust enforcers for a couple of years now, although, you know, Lena Khan has definitely brought it to the forefront in a major way with this rule.
Before we go further into this, I just would like to get your perspective, if you have one, on where the rules here in the United States compare with, for example, the EU and other sort of Western industrialized companies with respect to this kind of regulation.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that these non-compete agreements have been a staple of American economic life for centuries. I mean, even in the proposed rule, we see sort of information about the non-competes being in place in the 1800s and being something that's come to attention of the law in even way back in England in the common law days and, you know, before America even existed. So I think there's something that have always been around, you know, and one of the interesting things actually about the final proposed rule is that it only applies to American workers. So, for example, I think there were comments at the proposed rule stage about, well, you know, the FTC should make clear that that businesses can still create non-competes to prevent, say, Chinese companies from trying to hire away workers with sensitive business information that, you know, that isn't as protected under some of the intellectual property laws in places like China, to sort of protect American business and protect American innovation and from that sort of international competition for workers.
Now, that's really interesting. Let me get this straight. Are we talking about a population of American companies that employ a Chinese worker? And we're saying, and the FTC is saying, yeah, those are not subject to this work rule. Have I got that right?
What we're saying is American companies can say, employee, you are not allowed to go work for a company in China within a certain amount of time after working for us.
Oh, so
you're not allowed to, yeah.
So even if, like, I have an employee in California, and I can say, I can't do a non-compete generally, but I can say you can't go to China. Is that basically right?
Basically right, although I will say that California has had a ban against non-competes for many years. So California is maybe not the example, but you know, again, the FTC would also say that, you know, non-competes are not the only way to right. do this. You can also say, you know, have penalties for misappropriation of trade secrets and all of those things like that. But yes, generally, I think that's right.
Okay, so that we've talked a little bit about how we got there. Let's talk about why. Always, I assume, when you're dealing with FTC promulgations, they have to justify the underlying regulation with some kind of economic analysis. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, what the commission argues are the deleterious effects of these non-competes that should be addressed by this prohibition.
Yeah, so proponents of the rule say that in the aggregate, non-competes harm worker mobility, they depress wages, and they make it less likely that workers will create their own businesses, that they sort of chill workers from leaving their employment for higher wages, or chill workers from leaving their employment to start their own business with their own ideas and innovations that, you know, aren't necessarily confidential business information they've taken from their employer, but are sort of new and ideas of how to compete. And that non-competes sort of stifle that. You know, those opposing the rule say the economic evidence is much more ambivalent, and it's, you know, non-compete agreements have always been subject to various state laws, and courts in those states have sort of taken a case-by-case evaluation of non-competes and said, yeah, maybe there are some non-competes that are very broad in scope, in geographic scope, or in time scope, or in terms of what is, you know, appropriate competition and not, but really these should be adjudicated on a case-by-case basis, and this sort of broad-based ban is not appropriate in this area.
How much of an impact could this have on innovation?
So I think that's something, you know, that remains to be seen. I think there's definitely the potential that a real broad-based ban throughout the U.S. might stifle innovation. Will companies want to continue to invest in their employees to the degree that's necessary for training and keep their competitive edge if there are no protections in place to prevent those employees from taking that knowledge and applying it to competitors? Are there, you know, adverse consequences to innovation when former executives some founder who has had an idea for a company and folks want to invest in that company, but the founder could just leave and start competing against the business right away? Are folks going to want to invest in that company? So, you know, I think it, like I said, it remains to be seen, but it could definitely have some effects on innovation throughout this country.
Well, you gave the example of, you know, owner starting a company and having no kind of tether and could go off and start a rival company. You know, you had, I guess what the FTC is saying is these non-compete agreements aren't the way to do this. Are there other, other preferred agreements that could maintain that kind of security for a business?
Yeah, I think that the FTC, in the FTC's view, you could have a confidentiality agreement that would prevent an employee from using trade secrets or other confidential business information to compete against the company. You could have some sort of program where if you provide training to employees and an employee leaves within a certain amount of time, you could require employees to pay back the reasonable costs of that training. The FTC rule would prevent a de facto non-compete. So that's where, you know, potentially it's not called a non-compete agreement. But for example, the business, you know, says you have to pay us back some, you know, very significant financial sum if you leave. And so in practice, it prevents the employee from leaving due to sort of financial consequences. So, I think proponents of the rule say, yeah, there are all sorts of other agreements that you could put in place with employees to accomplish the same goals. And sort of, you know, people who oppose the rule are saying, well, it's not so easy. There are loopholes with these other types of agreements. You know, if somebody's misappropriating trade secrets, you might not know that until the damage has already been done. Then it's sort of too late. So there's a lot of back and forth about, you know, whether or not the ban will truly sort of result in, you know, the same amount of protections just through other means or not.
I want to get to the legal challenges, but one thing you mentioned a minute ago that I want to make sure I understand. A classic sort of scenario for non-compete is if I am the founder of a company, it's got my name on the door, I sell it. And you can certainly understand why a buyer would not want me to go next door and open my business all over again. There is some narrow exception that allows those kinds of agreements, isn't there?
That's exactly right. So in the context of a sale of a business, the FTC rule would allow a non-compete agreement in that context. So if you are selling your business, the buyer can say, okay, seller, I don't want you to just turn around and, you know, after you've gotten my money for your business, go next door and open up, you know, your new venture with all of my clients and all of the sort of information that you've just, you know, sold to me. So that definitely is something that the cons opposing the rule push back pretty hard on, and the FTC did change between the proposed rule and the final rule.
Okay, so let's go to the conference room at the Chamber of Commerce, who's undoubtedly, I think they already have filed legal challenges, and talk about what's on the whiteboard as to what the legal theory behind what the FTC did is and how they can challenge it.
Yeah, so the FTC brought this rule purporting to exercise its authority under Section 5 of the FTC Act, which allows the FTC to prevent unfair methods of competition. And this is a really amorphous law.
Like so much of antitrust law.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it's even taking antitrust law, which is already very sort of, you know, case by case and fact specific. And, it purports to sort of reach beyond antitrust law into things that are sort of unfair and tend to negatively affect the market. And so maybe if you can't bring a full-throated antitrust challenge, there's still something bad and we don't really like this. And so the FTC can move to prevent it under its Section 5 authority. And, you know, the Section 5 authority has been very, again, sort of by case, just when they see something one company is doing, bringing a challenge against that and sort of preventing the company from engaging in that conduct in the future. But what is really new is whether the FTC can create a nationwide substantive rule about unfair methods of competition. And, that's what the Chamber of Commerce and others who have brought these lawsuits are really focused on. Like, this rule purports to ban all non-compete agreements as unfair, even though, some non-compete agreements have been, and many in the courts actually have been upheld as, you know, reasonable in time and scope. and that they do not have adverse effects on sort of the market as a whole. And that the core system and the sort of the patchwork of state laws that we have now is sufficient to stop abuse of non-competes where they are truly sort of overreaching, but you know, are able to strike this balance on the case-by-case basis, because you know they're looking at specific non-competes in specific industries, specific employees, things like that. Whereas this is just a complete broad-based rule that also retroactively wipes out a bunch of contracts, millions of contracts across the country.
One question I had, you had mentioned, again, that there are different state laws that prohibit non-compete clauses or govern it. You had mentioned that California prohibits it. Is what's being proposed by the FTC not being proposed? What's been approved by the FTC, does that exactly mirror California, or is that taking it another step?
You know, it's taking it, I think, another step. California and other states who have, there are a couple of other states who have banned them as well, but I think the FTC's rule is really, really broad in scope and, focused on not even de facto non-competes that aren't, non-competes in as we normally would think of them. And just, getting rid of all of these contractual provisions throughout the country. So I think it is broader, and it obviously reaches, way outside of sort of the state law limits where I think businesses have sort of understood what was within bounds in California and other states, and now it's just completely open. You can't have them at all, or even purport to enforce them or anything like that.
You said something interesting that I've been thinking about, and I want to go back to, which is that there are going to be challenges to this law, I'm sure, on the substance, but the sort of procedural notion of the FTC coming out with a rule that functionally invalidates all these contracts, that feels more like a legislative a promulgation rather than sort of an administrative interpretation. Is this, is this unique? I mean, they've never done anything like that before, have they?
They have not. This is new. I mean, I think that this is, again, one of the bases for the legal challenges is that the FTC Act gives FTC certain powers to make certain types of rules, but this type of substantive rule that would, purports to preempt state law, mm-hmm. Is really something that Congress should be doing, and it's not something that the FTC has authority to do. And the chamber and other litigants have said, like, even when Congress has had the ability to or has looked back at the FTC Act and has made changes to the law to allow FTC for different ways to exercise power, they have not ever given FTC this sort of real broad-based substantive rulemaking ability to just declare one type of conduct, an unfair method of competition as a blanket.
So knowing that, this is a rule that the FTC has put in place, that's where a lot of the legal questioning is going to occur. Could a new administration simply come in and reverse it?
So I think it's a little bit more complicated than that with the FTC right now, and always. There are five commissioners of the FTC, three Democrat commissioners and two Republican commissioners. And so typically what happens with a new administration is that the chair of the FTC resigns, and that allows the administration to appoint a new FTC chair and a new commissioner that would give the administration's party the most votes. So, in this case, I think that if there was a new administration, Lena Khan does things differently, but she would resign if she uh-huh. follows the typical practice, and then the new administration would appoint a new commissioner, and then the commission would vote to withdraw the rule.
Okay, so let's talk about what's going to happen during the litigation. First question is, were the challengers, I don't know if you know the answer to this, were the challengers strategic in judge shopping? Did they pick a forum where they thought they might have a better shot at success as you look at where they filed?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, the Fifth Circuit in Texas is generally not big fans of government regulation or the FTC, and so I think that they definitely were keeping that in mind when they chose to file in Texas. There's also actually one lawsuit that was filed in Pennsylvania So I don't know exactly what the rationale behind that was, but I think that the challengers to the rule are definitely hoping for a favorable judge and favorable Fifth Circuit precedent to help them sort of, you know, put a stop to this rule. And really, I think the most important thing right now is whether they can get a preliminary injunction or a stay of the rule so that it doesn't go into effect when it is supposed to on September 4th.
So as of now, it goes into effect unless they get some kind of judicial ruling that would stay it, which I'm sure they're going to move for.
Correct. Yes, they have moved for that. And the judge has said in the chamber and the Ryan LLC case, which are now they're both being tried together. The judge has said that the court will rule on that by July 3rd. So we should have that answer in the coming months.
So, Anna, you've walked us through, you know, all the different aspects of what this could be. What does your crystal ball tell you about where this will end up?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we're looking at a very long road of litigation here. I mean, no matter which way the lower courts go, I think this is going to be tied up in appeals and litigation for a long, long time, with a potential Supreme Court ruling about the FTC's authority. And, you know, one thing that's going to be very interesting to watch is whether, you know, the FTC should have tried to bring a sort of more narrow rule, even though they are seeking to expand their authority under Section 5, if sort of a more narrow rule would have been wiser for them to bring so that their more general authority, you know, would be upheld. It'd be, you know, a little bit harder for courts to strike them down as opposed to sort of this really broad nationwide state ban preempting state law, you know, getting rid of all these contracts, whether, you know, that's going to be sort of their downfall and sort of overreaching and ending up in a worse place than they were before they started. We'll see.
Well, it sounds like something that you're going to be keeping your eye on.
100%. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, Anna. Thanks for spending time with us on Mountain Money.
Adrian Freck is a medical sociologist and associate professor of population health at The Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine, and had studied the impact of unsecured debt on health conditions. Adrian joins us this morning to take us through the report's findings, showing how stress of carrying unsecured debt throughout adulthood is also linked to poorer physical health conditions, including pain that interferes with daily activity. Adrian, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with what caused you to investigate the topic. What brought you to looking into unsecured debt and its relation on health?
Sure. Well, first, I should start by describing, for anyone who doesn't know, what unsecured debt is. Unsecured debt is the kind of debt that's not tied to an asset. And specifically, that's things like credit card debt, medical debt, payday loans. And so that relates to why we wanted to investigate it more, because unsecured debt is more likely to be stressful. It's usually taken out during conditions of duress. So it's not something like planning for the future, like taking out a mortgage to get your home debt. This is something where you're meeting needs in the present and then paying them off in the future. We thought that might line up pretty well with the epidemiology of chronic pain. Pain is often caused by inflammation. There are also associations with poor mental health and associations with stress. Debt is known to cause all of these things. Poor psychological well-being, higher stress, which then also causes higher inflammation. So no one had studied this yet, this relationship between unsecured debt and pain specifically.
And I think for me, I think of secured debt, like your home or your car could provide, you know, higher stress if you were to lose those. But yet I think you explained that it's more about when it was the debt was taken out and why that could be causing a lot of these issues.
So yeah, absolutely.
So how do you create a research methodology to do this? And you know, what kind of data sources were you able to investigate?
Well, I don't know how complicated you want me to get on the research methodology, but I can tell you that
maybe half an inch. Go ahead.
We decided to use data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics has a couple of data sets where they follow the same people every year or every other year for a really long time. And so this is data on baby boomers, people who were born between 1957 and 1964, and they were interviewed every year or every other year from 1979 onward. And so we have information about their work habits and their debt, and we have some information on health outcomes. And some of these data start as early as ages 14 or 15. And today, these people are in their 60s. And so what we wanted to do was track their history of unsecured debt. And so for this study specifically, we're looking at ages 28 to 40, and then we're looking at their health at age 50. And the methodology we use is something that looks at this whole population's pattern of unsecured debt and looks for groups of people who have different patterns of debt accumulation within that population. Because if you just look at everyone on average, it looks like people have a relatively stable amount of debt or that they pay down debt over time. But when you use these different methodologies, you can see there are actually quite a few patterns that are underlying that average over time.
And then do you compare sort of people with sort of higher incidences of debt and their health conditions to those with lower and their health conditions? Are you trying to try to derive whether or not there is a significant health impact? Is that what's going on here?
That's exactly it. And when we look at those patterns, the thing that we become most concerned about, the first thing we see, is that the most common pattern in our sample, 35% of baby boomers had a constant level of unsecured debt. And so right at the bat at age 28, we saw that they were carrying debt, and that unsecured debt stayed the same all the way through age 40, which suggests that they were able to pay down the interest, but not much more. And we compared that with people who didn't have any unsecured debt. They basically didn't have credit cards, or they paid them off every month. And not surprisingly, the people who didn't have very much debt did have lower pain and better health. But we actually found that people who had debt early on and paid it down by the time they were 34 or 35 still had higher incidence of pain compared to the people who didn't have any debt. And so there was still a penalty of taking out debt, even if you paid it off. But of course, the worst debt of all was people who either had constant high debt or had recent debt, especially because they're experiencing this debt at midlife, as opposed to a younger age when they might have some time to pay it down.
And trying to think through like the question that's in my head and how to get it out of my mouth. So when you talk about, you know, pain and their instance of pain at 50, how does pain manifest itself in health conditions?
Sure. So the questions that the sampler are asked about pain that interferes with their daily activities. And so this could be pain that limits the amount you can work, or just pain you experience at work, so maybe like carpal tunnel or lower back pain. But this can also be pain that you experience in your everyday non-work activities. So it can be something like, you know, lifting objects in your home, or again, just something like back pain. So individuals are asked whether they experience a kind of pain that interferes with their life, and then they kind of report the severity of that pain. And then we also ask a yes-no question on whether they experience just everyday pain and stiffness. But I don't know. I mean, I'm in my 40s. It's not surprising to me that when I look at these questions, I'm seeing 50% of the sample reports pain and stiffness. And so we do see some differentiation on that outcome, but pain and stiffness is also very common in 40s and 50s.
Okay, so this sounds like you have this really fun data set, almost like a researcher's dream, that you can use to sort of try to draw some conclusion. My understanding is that previous studies concerning health consequences of debt have had two primary limitations. What were those limitations, and how was this data set allow you to overcome them?
Yeah, so one of the main limitations of prior research is that they looked at the relationship between debt and health over a really short span of time. And so we're looking at debt or unsecured debt, let's say in 2011 or 2021, and then looking at someone's health in 2022. So that gives you a better claim to causality. In other words, it's easier to say, oh, it looks like it's pretty clear that the debt caused this pain because not much else changed for the person over the course of a year or two. But the drawback of that is that chronic pain takes a long time to develop, and debt is most harmful when it's held for a long time. So while those previous studies might have been able to draw a straighter line between debt and health, we're able to draw a longer-term picture of how both of those kind of accumulate, especially into midlife. I think the other thing that we're really capturing is that debt is tied to stress. And so by picking pain as an outcome, we're really picking a health experience that lines up really well with debt, as opposed to, and other studies that have done this have been fantastic. But I think that some of their measures of health haven't been quite as aligned with unsecured debt specifically and the stress it causes.
So you talked a little bit about the life cycle model of debt. Can you talk a bit about, you know, percentage of people that this that typically follow this model, and really how many people are we looking at that are experiencing debt in a way that's more harmful?
Sure. So the life cycle model of debt lines up really well with maybe what we want or expect adulthood to look like, which is that you take on debt when you're young, and it's this process of income smoothing where you take on debt so that you have enough to meet your basic needs, maybe to make a plan for the future. And as you get older, the idea is that your assets go up and your income goes up. And so it's less stressful to pay that debt down in the future when you're earning more than it would have been to kind of do without that when you were younger. And so the life cycle model of debt says take it out when you're young, pay it down as you age. And while you're paying it down, you're increasing your assets, you're increasing your income. We found only about 12% of our sample experienced this life cycle model of debt. There are all kinds of reasons that it can happen. I want to, you know, go back to this idea again that unsecured debt is taken out in times of stress. So we might talk about, you know, better financial management and people not running up big credit card bills. But the degree to which we see people coming in at age 28 with higher levels of unsecured debt suggests that these are people meeting their basic needs. These are credit card debts related to things like grocery bills, as much as their extravagant trips to a restaurant or extravagant trips.
Okay, so let's just talk about where does this go in terms of, you know, sort of health policy. What is the argument that this information tells us that we should be looking at from a policy perspective or from a medical perspective?
Yeah, I think that one of the main things that I would say about this study is that we started too late by starting at age 28.
Wow.
If you look at the distribution of wealth that we have in this study, which is that more than half of the sample has significant unsecured debt already by age 28, and only about 18% of our sample is not carrying a lot of unsecured debt by age 28. That means that we need to do more when people are younger. And so what are the needs? Again, this is baby boomers, but what are the needs of younger people today? Well, one, of course, is they have enormous amounts of student loan debt, but we're still balancing that against the idea that a college degree is necessary in order to enter into and stay in the middle class. And so whatever we can do to help to more exactly match costs that people experience when they're young to the incomes that they're likely to gain when they're young will keep people from bridging that gap with unsecured debt.
Actually, it's really interesting. Because your study had baby boomers, it doesn't reflect any of the sort of current model of student debt.
It does not. And so it also doesn't reflect the existing need for a college degree. And so in this baby boomer sample, I think it's somewhere around 25% have a four-year college degree. It's not a ton of people. So the kinds of debts that they have are store debts, credit card debts. Payday loan debts really are a minority of what we have in our study. So we're still finding that in this generation where, you know, we think of the model of, you know, earning father and a stay-at-home mother, which according to research is actually not a very good model for this baby boomer cohort. But if we imagine that model and we think, oh, well, of course they're buying a house when they're young and they're going right into the workforce because a college degree is less necessary, that's really not the reality that has borne out for the baby boomers.
I think I'm having an aha moment, and because of the fact that this is, again, the study of a baby boomers, and think about even when they were at 28, what credit opportunities were available. It's not the same as what's as expansive as it is today. Credit cards weren't like they were back then.
Exactly, that's true. And that's why some of this includes things like store debt. And so debt that you might own to a business or department store. And so that's included too. But again, medical debt is as well. And all of these things that we've seen, you know, grow enormously in the last 20 years or even 40 years weren't as bad for the baby boomers, but they were still taking on some of these debts.
We've talked a lot about pain. Are there other health conditions that you saw that directly link to the amount of debt being carried?
Well, my co-author, Jason Houle, had a study previous to this one that looked at mental health outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so these same trends that we're seeing with physical health and pain, people have also seen with mental health. There are also measures of self-rated health, life satisfaction, that are also associated with debt. Those studies, though, apart from Dr. Houle's, those studies, though, again, go back to this idea of examining debt over a slightly shorter time span.
If you were able to, have a wish granted, what kind of data would you like to look at today to understand this better?
Oh, that would be an amazing question.
She specializes in that.
I would say, in this study, it's a Bureau of Labor Statistics study. They have outstanding data on how people have participated in the workforce. They only have data every 10 years on these health and pain outcomes. Yeah. And so I would really like much closer measurement between when the debt is taken on and what their pain or any other kind of health outcome is. Because really, with these Bureau of Labor Statistics data, we're looking at health at age 40 and then at age 50 and then at age 60, which is critical. But of course, in my dream, I would like it at every single age.
Okay. Well, and we're going to talk more about your dreams, because one of the things about academia is that when you finish a study like this, you're always thinking about what you're going to do next. Talk to us a little bit about areas in this topic that you'll continue to delve into. Where do you want to go next with this kind of areas of research?
Well, I'll tell you, but it might be a little bit depressing. I'm interested in people's 40s and 50s and even into their 60s. And part of that reflects the fact that these Bureau of Labor Statistics data, the baby boomers, they're entering into their 60s now. And so this is the newest data we're getting. So it's the most exciting to me. But what I'm seeing in other research that I'm doing is that if you look at, again, overall trends of income versus the underlying patterns of income, you'll see that for baby boomer men, income is relatively stable. Now, stable isn't bad, but stable also isn't enormous growth over time. And also what we're seeing in other related work is that there's a lot of movement out of the labor force, especially for men. And I would say especially for men that we wouldn't expect. And so we, again, have this expectation for baby boomer men that they start into the workforce and really they work for as long as they physically can. And so we have some research out there that says that that's not really true, that by men's 50s, many of them have started to move out of the workforce, whether that's due to disability or to their skills being phased out or to some other reason. And so what I'm really interested in is movement out of the labor force and how that's associated with both debt and health. And so I prefaced it at the beginning with it might be a little bit depressing, because I think it's something to worry about and something to pay close attention to.
So that's interesting. One possibility is that if they're being phased out involuntarily, you might see a growth in debt and adverse health outcomes, both from sort of depression and other kinds of issues of, not feeling like you're carrying your weight anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And we really, work is central to our identities.
Right.
And that's true for men and for women. It's right. Just these most recent studies I've been doing have been more on men.
Who do you hope pays attention to these studies? Whose attention could you grab that starts to make some differences in this area?
I would love to see more federal policy that helps to support financial stability for people of all ages. And so, of course, the federal government, I think, is the strongest place to do that, because there's other research out there that shows that things like state-level differences in minimum wage are associated with health. And so if we had a higher federal minimum wage or a minimum wage that matched with how people could meet their basic needs, that would help to mitigate unsecured debt, especially earlier in life when people are more likely to earn minimum wage. I would like to see better, just a better safety net for the people who are the poorest off.
Well, we've truly enjoyed this conversation, even though the topic is not necessarily a happy one. We've been speaking with Adrienne Fretz. She is a medical sociologist and associate professor of population health at the Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine. Adrienne, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Formerly Caribbean Dream and Scuba, the Park City Dive Shop is under new ownership. Patrick Fabian and Catherine Semerano, the new owners, join us this morning to share how they can train you how to scuba dive right here in Utah. Patrick and Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
How long, let's begin, how long has there been a dive shop in Park City? And then how did it come on your radar to look into purchasing it?
Yeah, I'll take that one. The shop has actually been in town for about 10 years or so. I was at the gym one morning, got introduced to Brian Frost, who's been a longtime member of the dive shop, and he's a certified instructor. I met him at the gym one morning, and we were able to collaborate, and he told me that the shop was for sale, and so we went over and met the old owner and pretty much struck up a deal right away, and were able to take ownership of the shop.
Okay, and when did that happen, Patrick?
About December 1st is when we officially renamed it Park City Dive Shop and opened it up.
Catherine, where is the shop located? Is it still in the same place it was before?
Yeah, so it's actually in the Silver Mountain Building in Kimball Junction.
All right.
Yeah.
So doesn't sound like there would be room for a swimming pool there. What exactly do you do in the shop?
So in the shop, we do have retail. We do host some of the classes. There is a classroom aspect of getting certified. So we'll have you there in the classroom. And then for the pool, we actually have a great relationship over at Ecker Middle School, and then as well as North Summit in Colville. So those are the two pools that we use. And then for your open water certification, we do go down to Midway to the Homestead Crater.
So there's different types of certification. How long, you know, does it typically take for, let's say I want to just go scuba diving on my vacation?
Yeah.
What does that look like if someone comes to you with that question?
Yeah, we get a lot of people here in Park City that want to get certified last minute, so know that we can facilitate that. We can get you done within about 4 days or so, and that's a basic open water certification to, you know, enjoy your vacation, go down to about 60 feet, be able to, you know, enjoy the basics there. So then we also offer specialty courses, nitrox, buoyancy classes, wreck diving, night diving, and so on. Those we run periodically, so check in with us. Go onto the website, and from there you can be getting our emails with different updates of the classes that we're offering. Typically, though, we do offer the open water class sessions once a month. So we can get you, if you plan ahead, then we can make sure that you have time, we get you in and facilitate that throughout the month.
So the first model you talked about, the four-day model, is one where you would do all, you know, that's getting all the classroom work done in the 4 days, and then you'd go get your open water on vacation. Is that model?
That's more of like a rushed,
right,
you know, model.
That's,
that would be
private.
Something that we facilitate for you.
Right.
If you're like, oh no, this is what we had planned, and we need this certification to do it.
Give us the more normal routine.
Yeah.
The private model, you know, it's, well, and basic routine, we're an SSI shop, Scuba Schools International, and Patty and SSI are the main international scuba shops or certifications globally. So being SSI is actually it is wonderful. They have a beautiful online platform. And so once you get registered with us, then we can set you up on the platform, on the app, and you can do all your academic work there. We come into the shop, and then we can just do a basic review. From there, then we can just get right into the water. And so it speedlines the process to be able to get into the water faster and be able to go through those skills and get you certified at a quicker rate.
So you'll do about 2 or 3 pool sessions, and then you'll have 2 open water dates where you'll complete 4 dives total at the Homestead Crater.
And how many, you have ongoing classes, you said, how many people can you fit in a typical lesson?
Yeah, typical class, depending on age, we can fit about 6 to 8. If we have a couple of students under the age of 15, the ratios need to be a little different just so we have, you know, better control of that. But, you know, and if we have more interest, you know, we have, and Brian is a wonderful member of our shop, and hopefully we can gain interest, and hopefully the listeners are getting intrigued here, and if we can fill up classes, then we can run, you know, more a month, so please come and sign up.
Well, you talked about kids as young as 14 or 15. How young do you see them? And, of course, the question that I would have is, how old do you take them?
So I have a wonderful student right now named Jack, and we're actually doing his first open water tonight down at the crater. I know he's excited and probably in school right now, so he's not listening, but he's 11 and, you know, doing wonderfully. It's fun to see. We actually get a fair amount of kids. You know, the parents may already be certified, and they want their kids to be certified when they go on vacation. So, you know, at 10, you can get certified. One thing we're excited about in the future, probably won't be able to get it done this summer, but by next summer, opening up a Explorers Camp, and that'll be ages 6 to 10. I know here in Park City that we need more summer camps. They fill up fast, so we're really trying to offer it's called the Explorers Program, and it's going to be ages 6 to 10, where then you can learn about basic aquatic safety, learn about snorkeling. There's going to be a mermaid program where you can learn about monofins, and I know that will intrigue some interest. And then the big thing that we're wanting to offer is the ecology classes, where you can then learn about sea turtles, sharks, stingrays, and basic marine ecology.
So you notice he avoided the old person question.
Well, I know I wanted to go there. I have like five different questions, but yes, could any age, is there an age maximum?
No. So as long, we have medical SSI and the shop, we have medical forms, as long as you can, and feel comfortable able to do it, we'd love to have you. People that are already certified, I want to make sure that if you're needing an update, we do a scuba skills update. We can offer that, at any point in time. And that's just a basic pool session where we can go in and review setting up the gear, getting in the water, practice your buoyancy, make sure you're comfortable ascending, descending, and reviewing the basics. And so you feel comfortable going on your vacation.
Okay, so we've probably sort of touched on this, but I want to make sure I get it. I'm not in a hurry, but I want to be able to get certified. How many hours am I going to spend on the computer doing my classwork? Then how many sessions with you in the water? And then how many sessions open water, pool, and then open water? Just go through the routine.
Yeah, so the basic course is about 16 to 20 hours.
Okay.
That you're going to spend all together. Academic, everything.
Okay.
Academic work, pool sessions, and the open water dives to get fully certified.
And when I look to scuba dive, is there any investment in equipment that I need to make in order to make those lessons happen?
Absolutely. I mean, just like skiing here in Park City, we know that if we have our own gear, we're more comfortable, we're enjoying it. Same with scuba diving. So, we for the open water classes, we try to have people have their own mask, fins, and snorkel, and that's just the basics. And then, you can go as far as your buoyancy, the BC, the buoyancy compensator, your own regulators, tanks, and everything. We do supply that for the classes. Having your own gear really sets you up for success and has you more comfortable, confident. And when you're more comfortable and confident under the water, you're enjoying it more. And we're paying money to go see things under the water. Investing a little more into your own equipment is just going to make that more enjoyable.
And just for those who don't really understand it like me, the equipment we're talking about, the buoyancy controller, is that a fancy word for a weight belt?
a buoyancy compensator, look at it as like your lungs, right? And mm-hmm. And our lungs are our own personal buoyancy compensator. So when we go into the water, if we inhale, right, we ascend. If we exhale, we will sink a little. Mm-hmm. We have weights to then help compensate for that. Because if we have an exposure suit or our wetsuit or something, we might be more buoyant, right? Positively buoyant. We're more floating to the surface, if you will. Weight belts will help, reduce that and get us under the water. A buoyancy compensator, is the jacket that you typically see scuba divers in. And that's going to help add air. It's a multi-purpose tool, but it's going to help you get under the water. It's going to help you control your buoyancy is the main part of it. And so when we're diving, we want to be neutrally buoyant, and then so we're not bouncing off the bottom, we're not hurting any marine life or coral or anything like that. And then we're enjoying. We're swimming at a, even plane. And when we breathe in, we should rise a little. When we breathe out, we should descend a little. And so that's a big thing that we practice in the classes is neutral buoyancy. And we have all sorts of type of skills and practices and fun things to help you master your buoyancy.
So, you mentioned that you and Catherine, you two had taken over the business in December. You had some experience diving before this, right? Because when I think about the way you're able to explain everything to me, your ideas for camps and everything else like that, like it sounds like this is a passion.
I run two other businesses, and Core Cleaning Solutions, carpet cleaning, spa tender for hot tub repair and maintenance. I finally have my third business that's a passion business.
There you go.
And I'm excited about that. And I know my wife is, she's full-time in the shop now. She's loving it. We love to be in the water. I've been diving since 08 when I got certified in college, and I did a semester abroad in the Australia, dove a lot on the Great Barrier Reef. And from there, it's been a passion. My wife has supported me all along the way. She doesn't dive at the moment. Well, she's also pregnant. We're expecting our second child. But, you know, we love to be in the water. It's a passion. Talking about the marine ecology and everything, we're in a beautiful space here in the mountains, and we love everything that it has to offer. But here in Park City, we get a lot of people that like to travel, and most of that travel is to tropical and beautiful places. If we can learn about the ecology and then be able to dive and go into the environment, it's a beautiful other aspect that we can train people for here.
All right, and I feel like, too, this is kind of just, it's almost like fate how it fell into our laps. We were the couple that were always going on vacations. He was diving. I would sit on the boat and hang out and snorkel. And we'd always say, you know, how cool would it be a retirement plan to have a dive shop in a beautiful tropical area? And so this is kind of one step towards that.
Love, you know, that.
Okay. Well, we have to go. If people want to learn more about the, what's the website?
ParkCityDiveShop.com.
And what's the basic cost for a basic package, typically?
To get certified?
Yeah.
So that would be $550.
Okay.
Perfect.
Thank you, guys.
We've been talking with Park City Dive Shop. Thank you so much for joining us in studio. You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. If you like Mountain Money, let us know. Please leave a review.